Another area of tremendous scientific advance, which also brought with it significant bioethical issues, is the development of cardiopulmonary resuscitation and the related but separate technology of respirators or ventilators, devices that can breathe for someone or help a person who cannot breathe themselves. We'll begin at number 4.1 with the development of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and the little reddish pictures that I've used to illustrate the history are taken from the older manuals that the American Red Cross used to provide for people who were studying advanced cardiopulmonary resuscitation. They point out that there have been attempts since antiquity to find methods of reviving people who collapse, and of course the success of these methods depends on the reason the person has collapsed, but there was not such subtle distinction in ancient times, and so there are records of application of heat or of ashes or even of dung and of beating. Flagellation is a way of trying to revive or awaken someone who has suddenly become unconscious for whatever reason. Obviously it makes a very big difference whether the person is unconscious because they've simply fainted and are still breathing and their heart is doing just fine on the one hand, or if they've entered a ventricular fibrillation, if their heart is not pumping blood properly, and that's the reason that they've collapsed. So these methods will have varying forms of effectiveness depending on the reason for the person's collapse. More recent methods since the 16th century included trying to actually pump air into the person's lungs, often with a bellows, the device that is used to push out air towards a fire to keep it going brightly. And beginning in the 1700s and the 18th century, a variety of methods, some of them rather bizarre, hanging drowning victims upside down, which would have the effect of encouraging water to come out of their lungs, rolling people over a barrel, or putting them on a trotting horse to have them obviously be bounced up and down, and other more absurd and bizarre methods that we won't talk about. And in the 19th century, specifically, there was a method recommended that one roll the victim 16 times per minute from side to back, applying pressure to the back while they're flat, and then stretching or pulling on their tongue. But it really was in the middle of the 20th century that a more scientific approach to reviving people who were unconscious evolved. Modern CPR is the result of initial efforts on the part of Drs. James Allam and Peter Safar, who were particularly concerned with attempting to use expired air ventilation without using any equipment rather than simple manual chest compression. And the American Red Cross began at that point, that is in the middle of the 20th century, a nationwide campaign to teach mouth-to-mouth resuscitation for drowning victims. In the 1950s and 60s, the rather horrifying method of opening the chest with a knife, reaching in with your hand, and actually squeezing the heart, so-called open heart massage, was attempted. As I note, rather laconically, a number of observers have pointed out the success rate was very low. Obviously, without going into that, but it was really in the 60s that it was discovered that rather than trying to reach in with your hand, if you could simply push the heart, that is, push the ventricle, the portion of the heart that's primarily responsible for pumping blood, between the sternum, the breastbone, and the vertebrae, the backbone, if you could just squeeze the heart, although the amount of blood circulating is rather low, nonetheless it does mean that some blood is circulating, and if you can also get the person oxygenating that blood by breathing air into their mouth, well, that effectively is the birth of modern CPR. And it really was in the 1960s that the contemporary method of CPR came into existence. Now, a couple of things to note. The first is that cardioversion, the ability to shock the patient's heart out of ventricular fibrillation, the most death-dealing and most dangerous form of dysrhythmia, of abnormal heart rhythm, in which the heart is moving in a completely uncoordinated fashion and looks literally like a bag of worms. There you have throughout the heart just kind of uncoordinated movements which do not move the blood. When this happens to someone, they need to be cardioverted. All the CPR in the world will not get their heart beating normally. They need this electric shock. And indeed, it's being demonstrated that in terms of actually saving people's lives, people who have collapsed as a result of having had a heart attack, cardioverting them with a device that can be used safely is the most effective thing to do. And of course, one is seeing more and more of these in public places, even in malls and in various markets. For a variety of reasons, including transmissible diseases, the public is much less willing to engage in mouth-to-mouth air ventilation than it once was. Another point that needs to be made is that when CPR is done correctly in older patients, it is extremely likely that ribs will be fractured. And as we'll see, the ethical problem is that although CPR is life-saving for people who have collapsed as a result of a problem in their heart, that is, if you can get their heart going again, the rest of their body's moderately in good shape, if they can get their heart beating properly again, they can actually lead normal lives, go home again from the hospital and function. However, if a person has collapsed for some other reason, perhaps because they've had a massive stroke, a blood clot in their brain, or for some other reason, blood is not getting to their brain, perhaps rupture of an aneurysm, in that case, the problem is of a different kind. And as we'll see, the statistics for CPR do need to be divided out in terms of the sort of people who are receiving it, because people who have had an event that causes them to go into ventricular fibrillation will certainly profit from being shocked, from getting a cardioversion. But people who have had massive destruction to their brain tissue are simply going to be in states of prolonged life that otherwise would simply not happen if CPR were not used on them, if indeed they survive at all. So one of the controversial factors is that the statistics of success that were published in regard to the use of CPR in the late 60s have never been reproduced in any subsequent study. That is, the successful use of this modality as it was originally claimed, the statistics that caused it to become as widespread as it is, to the extent that unless you have permission on your chart not to have CPR, everyone admitted to a hospital facility will generally be forced to receive it. The statistics on which that approach was based turn out to be irreproducible, which strongly suggests that the data was not well collected, perhaps even that the data was manipulated to make it appear better than it was. And as we'll see in just a few minutes, real statistics about CPR are much more alarming and invite us to consider very carefully what it is that we're doing both for and to people, because there are a number of circumstances in which CPR is never of benefit to individuals. That is to say, there are diagnostic categories in which if you have this particular diagnosis and you need CPR, if it's given to you, you will never go home. The only thing that will happen is you will die more slowly, probably in an intensive care unit, having very painful things done to you. And one of the diagnostic categories is a cancer that is spread, metastatic cancer. Patients in that setting do not do well ever with CPR. And one of the reasons for this is that when your heart stops beating because you have metastatic cancer, it's not because you have a temporary fibrillation in your heart. It's more likely to be because the whole complex mechanism of keeping your body as an environment in which your heart can beat, all the chemical and oxygenation aspects of that that are so deeply intertwined, that's falling apart, that's not working, and simply pressing on a person's chest or shocking them will not restore the problems that are so massively deranged in that context. So CPR is both a tremendous blessing to people who have had cardiac events, and it can be a horrific curse to those who have diseases of which they are dying and in which this particular modality only serves to make their dying much more horrible. This is also to some extent true of respirators, number 4.2. That is a device that will breathe for you when you're no longer able to breathe for yourself. These are devices that began to be used in the early 1930s and the late 20s, and it was primarily as a result of the epidemics of polio that can paralyze the muscles that are responsible for breathing, as indeed all the voluntary muscles. So the polio victims were encased in devices called iron lungs, which would completely surround them from the neck downward, and that seems rather strange compared with the respirators that we use today, but in fact those devices were intended to mimic the normal way that we breathe. We do not breathe normally by having air forced into our lungs, but rather expanding our chests and having negative pressure within the lungs draw the air in passively. That's the way breathing normally takes place, and that was mimicked by the iron lung. However, modern respirators do not cause a passive introduction of air into the lungs. Rather, air is pushed, forced into the lungs, which is an abnormal experience of breathing. That is, you're pushing air into a very delicate organ system, which is not really accustomed to having to deal with positive pressure. So there are all kinds of problems associated with long-term respirator use because the modern respirator is in fact does not replace the natural process of breathing. It substitutes an unnatural form of airflow. If we drop down to some of the pictures, modern respirators, as I've noticed, offer positive pressure breathing, again, rather than the passive, more natural form that the older iron lungs provided. And when it's required for a long period of time, a hole is cut in the neck, and the tube is attached directly to the trachea for long-term maintenance. All bioethics Catholic bioethics experts with whom I am familiar would agree that that the use of a respirator is extraordinary, both because of the discomfort that it causes the individual, not necessarily surprisingly from the pain in their neck that after the surgical wounds heal is not as much of a problem as the inconvenience of having a device that is breathing for you in a way that you would not normally breathe. Now, having said that, air hunger, that is the experience of not being able to get enough air, is a terribly painful experience, and so most folks who can't breathe would prefer to have a device that would breathe for them rather than not to breathe at all. But the choice of being on or not being on a respirator is not in any sense something that is easily available throughout the world or something that can be accomplished without great inconvenience and even a pain or discomfort for the individual. So this is a modality that would always require, insofar as one can obtain it, the individual's consent. However, that's often not what happens, certainly not in emergency contexts. In number 4.3, I have the groundbreaking article published in the late 1980s by Dr. Leslie Blackhall, who was on the staff at the County Medical Center, the USC School of Medicine as well, in Los Angeles, and was an active part of their bioethics community as well. Dr. Blackhall did the work of amassing the statistics on cardiopulmonary resuscitation as best she could, and subsequent articles in this century have demonstrated that there really are not any significant statistical changes from the data that she amassed and the conclusions to which she came in this article. If you look at number 4.3, if you look down below that, New England Journal of Medicine sounding board, there are some very small links, web page, MS Word doc, and PDF doc. These will enable you to access Dr. Blackhall's original article containing all of its references and details if you wish to look at it in detail. I've only given you three paragraphs from it, points that we should be aware of, and her conclusions. She notes that survival after CPR is related to the underlying illness. Now, that's one of the problems in our hospitals. We do not often differentiate between someone who's been admitted to the coronary care unit and someone who is admitted to the general ward to be treated with yet another round of chemotherapy for their metastatic cancer. The rate of success for CPR in these two categories is radically different. And yet, the policy in virtually all institutions in the U.S. is that everybody will get CPR from the moment they enter the hospital unless there's a specific order countermanding this. But she points out that patients with certain conditions very rarely, and one can go even further than that and say that in some diagnostic categories, there is no documented survival to hospital discharge. That would be particularly the case in patients with cancer that is spread. She points out in the next paragraph another factor that a significant number of individuals who receive CPR go on to develop vegetative states. The existence of the persistent vegetative state, which we will look at very briefly in our review of bioethical documents in the 21st century and late 20th century, the existence of this phenomenon is a consequence of the availability of CPR and of respirators in the developed world, in the U.S. and Europe primarily. It is not a phenomenon that exists outside contexts where CPR is regularly performed. It is a side effect of the provision of CPR. And so that is something we need to bear in mind, that the terrible ethical problems that arise as a result of the persistent vegetative state are mostly, I mean, not absolutely always, but almost always, the result of the availability of advanced medical technology. This is an irony and a very peculiar phenomenon that we should probably ponder rather significantly. She describes those numbers and those statistics, and they've been documented in studies later. She concludes in this last paragraph, CPR is a desperate technique that works relatively infrequently and in many types of patients virtually never. One of the problems one faces is that the success rate after CPR on television is radically different from what one actually finds in hospitals. And this, too, has been documented in studies. So the public has a strange expectation of CPR as always life-giving, when in fact that is not the case. So the statistics have been available to healthcare practitioners since the 1980s. We're now several decades well beyond that. It's been documented over and over again that the statistics have not significantly changed, and yet it is still true that policies and practices in hospitals are still very often exactly what Dr. Blackhall described. That is, we do not often distinguish between patients who will profit from CPR and those who will not, and often this is because of the false expectations that that patients have, and tragically, a fear on the part of physicians that they will be sued for abandoning or not offering everything to patients, when in fact, in certain situations, what is being offered is in fact of no significant medical benefit to them. So, in the area of this tremendous area of medical advance, we nonetheless have some very important bioethical question marks and indeed issues of pastoral compassion and concern, which we will look at in more detail later in the course.